What if you could add hundreds of thousands or even millions in value to your commercial property? Hi, I'm Joe Kraus. I'm the co-host of the Property Pals Australia podcast. And in this episode, Sam and I chat to Steve Polizzi, who is the founder of the buyer's agency firm Polizzi Property, where they've bought over 1,000 properties for clients. And he also is the author of the book, Commercial Property Explained Simply. Now, in this podcast, Steve, Sam, and I share different ways that you can change the use of a commercial property and how that can allow you to add value to your property. We also discuss how either increasing rents or, quite controversial one, is decreasing rents and how that can allow your property to have more value as well. We also explain a multitude of different ways you can add extra revenue streams to your commercial property. And you can be as imaginative as you like with this based on the few different types of commercial properties, you know, industrial, retail, and office, and all the different things you can do with all those different property types. Steve, Sam, and I also share some stories of different commercial properties that have changed their usage or added revenue streams quite creatively that are great for you to experiment with and learn on your own as well. We also look at what it looks like when you're changing your property manager and how they can also help you increase the value of your commercial property as well. Now, there's so much value in this podcast. Go away and enjoy. Welcome to Property Pals, the podcast where we share everything around how to build a property portfolio, from researching areas, financing, structuring, buying, selling, and reinvesting to live a life of financial independence. As a disclaimer, any information shared by myself, Jared, Sam, and the Property Pals team is strictly general and should not be taken as constituting professional advice. You should consider seeking independent legal, financial, and taxation advice from a qualified professional. Steve, welcome back to the pod.
Hey, Property Pals, how you guys doing?
We're really good, thank you. Hey, how good, are you doing?
Mate. Do your mates call you that now? Do they call you the Property Pals?
Not really.
No, they call. Oh, yeah. I'm just still stuck in all the P's, mate, for this series.
Steve, it's better than my mates calling me the bare-chested investor is what my mates call me.
Well, that'll stick. Yeah. Maybe you should change your logos and your design. Rebrand, mate.
Just the beard, nothing else.
we're still up and comers. We're just new to this space. We're babies. Time of recording, we batch a lot. So we've probably only put out 40 episodes so far.
Only in quotation marks.
Oh, well, this is the turning point, mate. This is our 53rd episode, so we've sort of broken that barrier of 1 year, and we just wanted to celebrate by saying, you know, keep on board for the next year.
Absolutely. I think a lot of people don't realize how much work doing a podcast is. I think it's just like start, hour, you're done kind of thing. It's not that. It's the talking about ideas, the getting the people on, the prep, the pre-talk, the post-talk, the editing, like it all adds up. So when you say only 40, I know how much work that is. That's probably hundreds of hours worth of work total.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. But enough about the pod, Steve. Let's talk about property here. How to manufacture equity in your property, commercial property.
Yeah, yeah.
There's obviously three main sort of, I guess, commercial properties. So I guess we'd like to go through each one, like industrial, retail, and office for different value adds for different types. Where do you think we should start? Should we start with industrial first, I guess?
No, I'd say let's start with the different types of value add, because then I can explain with each type of commercial how that might change it, for instance.
Yeah, got you. Okay, what are those types of value adds? I mean, we've got some in the top of our head, and you know, working with you, I've learned a bunch as well, and even Sam and I were looking at this deal, thinking about value adds on this commercial property we're looking at now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, what are the key ones, I guess?
All right, so the first one I'll start off with is changing the property's use. So this is quite broad, but like you can repurpose the property, for instance. Like even just changing the type, like you might turn a warehouse, a big empty shell warehouse, into an office space if you get more per square meter for the office space. So where you might have, say, 20% office space and 80% industrial space, in that area, if it fetches a higher rate for office space, make it 50, 60% and kind of get it that way as well. Or alternatively, like turn it into like a retail showroom and things like that. Or even if you've got a retail shop and you think you're getting a good like office type tenant, for instance, like a medical or something like that, that can also add value to it as well. And then the other thing as well is if you own freestanding, for instance, you can do things with the other, like the spare space. So like in industrial, you might rent out the spare kind of lay down area, or you might have off peak. So a lot of like people with industrial sheds will let like cranes and trucks park there overnight, knowing they're going to get picked up at 6 a.m. So just changing what you've actually got into something else that has more value or gives you extra rents is a nice, easy way of doing things.
I got a question on the changing the use. Is a big implication, you mentioned last one of the last pods about car parking. If you do change from, say, an industrial to an office, are you sort of handicapped with what car parking you've got, or what's the situation there?
Yes, in theory. So, of course, you have to get council approval to kind of see kind of where it's at. But generally in that case, because like they might be working out a slightly higher square meter rate for per person for office, you still need to have the car spaces there, but they're still sort of allowing for that industrial anyway. So just might like that's, you're not going to go from like 0% office space to 100% office space. However, there's also ways around, like they're not actually going to care that much. Like if you're using the space and it's zoned for that, normally there's no limit on how many workers can be there besides from like an evacuation point of view. So the car spots aren't going to really affect it. Whereas with like, if you're putting like mezzanine areas, that's actually increasing the floor space. So when you increase the floor space, that's when you need the extra car spots. But if you're just converting the existing space into it, obviously you can't build like a triplex floor and have like 1,000 people in there. They're not going to allow that. But generally it's, I haven't seen it as a big issue, and you're normally not changing as much as you think. It'll normally be, say you've got something in an inner ring city and you see an opportunity, you go from like 20 or 30% to say 40 or 50%. You're not completely flipping this use.
Yeah, I saw there's one in Burley on the Gold Coast. It's like it's industrial along Christian Avenue, Jared, if you remember it. It's a black building, but it used to be like a mechanic kind of workshop, and they painted it all black, tinted it out, and then they polished the concrete on the floor and built in, you know, sort of like little open space office area with glass cubicles. Looks really cool, like really nice. Is that kind of,
I think there's one next to that as well. They went from similar, it was like a workshop area, industrial workshop area in that main part of the street, and they went from like a mechanic or a smash repair place to, I think it's now Precinct, it's like a bar.
Oh yeah, it's a brewery.
It's a brewery. So they've obviously gone from one type to a different.
Yeah, so funny you mentioned that. So I'm personally looking at the moment for a warehouse on the Northern Beaches. And when I'm looking at comparables, I found those exact two cases. So one of the exact comparables I saw, the square meter rate for sale was really high. I'm like, what's going on here? Oh, sorry, for rental was really high. And then I actually looked at it and it was a warehouse that's now a WOTSO share office. So they've done exactly that. They've realized they get a really good square meter rate by having lots of tenants effectively. And they've done that. And then the other one, because it's in Brookvale, there's about five or six breweries there. So they're all doing the same thing as well. They're converting either, some of them are retail. So some are like a retail shop fronty type one where they put the brewery out the back in a shed, and other ones are the big classic like industrial. But this is what I like about commercial, is you do have options. Like it's also what makes it complicated. But when you've got a 3 or 4 bedroom house, like some people will claim, oh yeah, you can do like micro dwellings, put in some bathrooms, make it a share house, and you can up the yield a little bit, but you're not changing the dial that much, nor are you changing the valuation. The bank won't come back and go, oh, because this is shared accommodation now, we're going to give you 20% more. But if you get 20% more rent in commercial, you've actually upped the price.
What's your viewpoint on that? Sorry, Jared. What's your viewpoint on those share houses? Like, I look at, like, if you're going for the income play, you're better off just going down the commercial route, because from a valuer's perspective, I valued a few of them back in the day, and you're bang on. You still have to, it's low density residential, so you have to value it as a residential property. So you don't really get any increase in value.
I'm a bit tainted because I hear the horror stories of them. People rarely call me up to buy commercial and say, oh, I've done great from this, that's why I'm going to commercial. The main issue is the people that are kind of selling them to you, that you don't get 100% occupancy because they're short-term lets. You've constantly got an influx of people which means so you might have, say, an 80% occupancy rate. So where they're like, oh, you get 50% more rent, you're not. You're actually only getting, say, 30% more rent. But in addition to that, you've spent quite a lot of money fitting out the multiple bathrooms and kitchenettes and all that type of stuff. But the biggest one I also find is maintenance is an absolute killer. Because you've got a constant flow of people, they just get grubbier generally, and you have to replace the carpet more. So they make a little bit of money, but it's for the extra money you've put into it, I would rather put into another asset and leverage, because that's the game of property is leverage.
I agree with you. Leverage is the way to go, and value adds are leverage, right? And would you say in general terms that, I know it's going to be very general here, because you could do so many, like you said before, there's so many things you can do to so many different types of property in commercial, and there's really no boundaries. Would you say though that industrial probably has more value add opportunities than maybe retail or office?
No, not necessarily. I would say that it has easier value adds, and we'll go into some of them later before I don't want to kind of ramble off now. It's just a bit easier because it is an empty shell and there's no sort of emotion in it. Office space, that's probably the least amount of value add, because besides the tenant, you can't really do much. There's some rent, like raising rents and stuff like that, but besides the tenant, you can't actually do much. Retail, surprisingly, there's a little bit more in regards to the actual property itself. So I'll go into that later, actually. I've got my dot points of value adds, and that'll kind of
let's go through your dot points of value adds. Have you got them categorized into each different industrial, retail, office, or
no? They're just general, but I'll talk about like industrial and retail and how they kind of affect each one. So we've sort of alluded into the next one. So raising the rents, or surprisingly, lowering the rents can actually help as well. But generally, raising the rent. So if you get something that's under rented by say 20%, and you push the rent up 20% to market rate, As Sam will let you know, the valuers will value the rent at the cap rate as long as it's obviously fair market rent. And then the value goes up as well. Whereas in residential, you can't push your, if you put your tenant's rent up by 20%, the value does not change at all. So commercial, the easiest one to do is find something that's under rented, bump the rent up, and you've effectively fabricated capital growth out of it.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah. What I sort of mentioned just there as well, which people kind of raise their eyebrows at, is actually lowering rents. Sometimes lowering rents, securing. If you've got, yeah, spot on. Securing a better quality tenant can actually help as well. There's certain incentives. Normally that's in regards to like if you own a retail strip. So like charging a lower rent to get in a different type of tenant, because that's all about foot traffic and road traffic. So if you have a lower rent, so the barber can actually come in next to the Coles, for instance, and then you get a medical center. Getting the right mix of tenants actually has quite a lot to it, which sort of flows on. I'll go into one of my later points as well. Removing underperforming tenants. So that's also a big one as well. So if you've got a tenant who's really struggling or isn't considered blue chip, or just like I said, if you don't have the right mix of tenants, fixing that up can actually change quite a lot. I've actually got a client who he doesn't actually buy properties through me, but I'm kind of like mentoring him a little bit. He actually buys shopping centers and removes all the tenants. So he completely scrapes it clean, refurbishes the site, and then puts in A-class tenants and gets 30, 40% that way. But that's high net worth stuff. You'd like to be able to do that. Yeah. But it just shows how important the actual tenants are in retails. And he's done it 4 or 5 times and made kind of 30, 40% every single time.
Wow. Hmm. How long does it take him to redo the whole establishment?
About 12 months is kind of to get it kind of tenanted up. The hardest thing when you rip out all the tenants, and I'm dramatizing a little bit. He doesn't just go through and completely rip them out. Like he'll kind of do one at a time as leases finish and things like that and clean it up that way. The issue with if you do it all at one time is it's really hard to tenant a completely vacant lot, even with industrial. So say you buy a whole industrial lot and it's got 10 different tenants. The first 50, 60% of the tenants try to get a bargain because they can pay off all the different owners, all the different assets. Like no one wants to be the only tenant in like a 10 complex retail or industrial. So the first 50, 60% is actually quite long to fill. And then the last 40% goes really quickly because everyone's like, you've got the precedence. They know what the going rate is. There's a demand to get in. So I'm pretty sure he just kind of like phases them out as the lease is finished and then brings in the new ones and refurbishes it over time. But the last one he did, he completely scrapped it. Spent, I think, about 400, 500 grand up doing the site, and it goes there, which actually flows into the next one. So the next one is improving the property's quality and image. So no different to Resi. You can do all that same stuff. Again, if you own freestanding, actually even body corporate for retail a little bit, but you can do the renovations, the refurb, make it look nicer, and then it's going to be more attractive to a tenant and they're going to pay a higher rent. And like I mentioned before in the last one, is getting the rent higher gets capital growth that way.
If you're looking at those types of deals, like, are you looking at those lease agreements, like, for that, like, client? Because it's you sort of hit on a point of a strategy that I've been pondering myself, is do you want those shorter lease agreements to be showing up? So you're sort of trying to get that discount, or on the way in with, like a lower security tenant, knowing that you want, you're doing that value-added strategy? Or are you just going down the path of, well, you know, we can look at break leases for these types of tenants. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, I generally don't try to break leases. The thing with commercial, you find what you find. So if you find something and it's under market rent and it's got 18 months left on the lease, I'm like, beauty, 18 months time I get to do the value add. But I'm also not angry if I find something with the same rent and it's got 5 years worth of lease on it, because that's good as well. But that's part of matching it up with the client. If the client needs a lease stock loan, for instance, finding something with a short lease doesn't actually help them. So it's more for the other ones. A lot of people get scared off by short leases, but I've said this on one of the other podcasts with you guys, is I don't care if it goes vacant in 18 months or 3 years' time. It's the same net result. You need to be buying with that long-term mindset. And because we call the tenant anyway, if they've got 18 months left on the lease and they say they're going to sign the next lease, I feel more safe with that than getting, say, a three-year lease where they've got no idea in 3 years' time if they're actually going to sign the next lease. But as per my favorite term, case by case, you just, what you find, you assess that with the client's risk, what you're actually trying to achieve from it. Some clients don't want any value add. They want complete set and forget. Personally, I buy a lot of set and forgets because I don't have the time or energy to actually do the value add.
I want to ask a question based on that, Steve, because I'm very curious. A lot of people, when they first get into property investing, get into residential. And typically, I feel that a lot of people just want to do flipping. They want to buy something in residential and flip it, make a bit of cash, and build up a more healthier deposit to buy larger properties. How prevalent is that in commercial property? Like, I have a sense that less people are trying to make money fast in when they're investing in commercial property and wanting to do flips. But is there a large portion of people out there that are like, maybe you're, you know, the person that you mentor, is he flipping these? And, you know, is there a percentage of people that do it this way?
Yeah, there's still a lot of
scale flip, like maybe
Spot on. So a lot of times they're high net worth people because you need the bankroll. It's not as easy for finance, like with residential kind of renovations and development and stuff, the banks kind of work with you. Whereas if you're buying a site that's empty, you need the serviceability to actually be able to buy it, which is quite hard. And because it doesn't have the tenant, you're paying the 10%. So there's a lot more kind of skin in the game to get it done. There are a lot of people doing it. Most of the time, you're selling with the purpose, though. So like you said, you're either going to upsize and keep moving and you're going to want to try to get wealthier and wealthier. But what I actually find most of them do is when they do, like, say, industrial development, they'll actually keep one or two of them and then kind of use the rest to go into the next one. Because the whole point, like, if you're doing that as a strategy, that becomes a job, which is fine. There's lots of property developers that are full-time property developers, but it's not passive. So most people's end goal with commercial is to build some form of passive income. So at some point, they're either going to hold an asset or hold part of it. If not, it's just their day-to-day job, which lots of people do. Same as Resi, there's full-time developers. But for me personally, like, I want the passive income. That's why I get into commercial. So I'm going to hold as much as I can.
Same with business as well. Like, I know people do this with business. They buy something, build it up, and then sell it. And we call it flipping online businesses. And I'm not an advocate for it at all, because not only are you continually working, you don't get the compounding growth from that asset. And then also when you're selling, you're continually paying these fees every single time you get in and out, right? The stamp duty fees and all these sorts of things. The entry and exit costs end up over like a 10-year period of you doing maybe five deals or flips. The compounding of that is insane as well.
Yeah, for me, it's more the risk. Like, doing a value add or a development or something like that comes with huge risks. So you only need kind of one burn and your tower of cards are going to fall down. So like you might keep scaling up. You're scaling the risk as well because you're going to the next bigger deal. If you have one, and like, no offense to people or developers, the market's been very kind to people the last 10 years. if we see a time where the market drops by 20% and their margins 15, 20%, they're going to have a hard time. So, and I actually think now's that's actually really hard time. I've personally tried to look at doing developments. the margins are so tight. It's gone are the days where you get 20, 30% easily. Like, I'm struggling to find something with the 20%, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. We kind of went off track there a little bit in terms of, like, you know, what's the end goal with your value adds. But yeah, we've covered, you know, changing the usage. We've covered increasing rents, maybe even decreasing rents, and then also, you know, removing underperforming tenants. What else have we got in terms of value adds? Yeah.
So the last one I mentioned is just improving the quality's image, which kind of got us onto that rant of just like renovating. One of the things I want to point out with commercial, though, if you've got a tenant, a lot of the times they actually will help you do that, sometimes at their whole cost. So I mentioned one of the previous ones we did, like my cafe tenant completely renovated the building at their cost. Sometimes if it's, say, like a medical, they might do it, but because they know they're medical, they'll ask for a contribution. So you might say, oh, look, I'll cover 30 or 50% of this renovation, but in return, either want the slightly higher rent to kind of pay it back, or you just sign a long lease. So I want a 5 or 10 year lease as security for kind of putting up this money, knowing that I'm going to get the capital that way. So anything you can do on residential that you think like, oh, it's a bit of a value add there, you can still do with commercial. There's just a few more moving parts. So the next one we will lead this into is creating new sources of revenue. So similar to what we mentioned before about those like share houses and things like that, you can also do that with commercial. So you can obviously like split tenancies up and do all that type of stuff. But then you can also add things. So like ATM machines, if you've got a retail, put one of those out the front, solar panels on the top, vending machines. I personally rent out car spots on one of my properties. Some people have storage cages or like I mentioned before with like having the cranes or the trucks kind of parked there. An interesting one I see kind of pop up now is off-peak rentals. So that's where like you might run a jiu-jitsu or CrossFit gym in the evenings, for instance, where your business might be an early morning one, like a, I don't know, 5 till 2 p.m. and you have two uses. So you almost have two tenants on the same property. One of the ones I see that is kind of office space as well. They might get like people that come in at nighttime and work from theirs, like share office or a personal business, things like that. I've got a client at the moment. We bought an Erina on the Central Coast, a little shopping strip. That was a good buy. Actually, it was 2.8 mil. I think it's got five tenants. They're at the moment in negotiations with the advertising space because it's a freestanding building on a highway. They've got an advertising space contract. Same as doing extra things like you can put like telecommunications on top. So I've had clients where they get literally $1 million 10-year contract from Vodafone to put telecoms on the top of their tower, and they get those upfront cash payment. Just word of warning though, read the sub clauses and that. There's a lot to it about you not able to sell the property and things like that. Or even just like I mentioned before with like the Brookvale warehouse, turning it into like a serviced office or something like that where it is like multiple tenancies and things like that. So you've got all the same thing as residential with extra tenants and granny flats and all that type of stuff, but you've got all of those I've just mentioned as well.
With those, I guess, billboards and things like that, like, do you get the agreement, like you sign that agreement with the provider, call it Goa, do they build it for you, or are you sort of like, oh, well, I'll put in the money to build that structure and you just, what's the sort of situation generally there?
In my defense, I've only kind of done it about five times. So it's a small sample size. I think it is just case by case. So sometimes like the one they've got is actually one of the electronic billboards. So they're not going to just kind of like find an electronic supplier and build it themselves. They're obviously going to have their recommendations. And then part of the lease agreement will either be they pay like part of the upfront to get it, or the rent's reduced because of it. So you're looking at your return on investment. But to answer your question, I don't actually can give you a proper answer because I think it is case by case.
As usual, that's all right, mate. Case by case.
I like the adding like new resources and new streams of revenue because it seems like it's like it'd be literally limitless in how you could do it based on all the different areas of the property, like even like putting like renting a space for a food truck or something outside of premises or
very easy one. If you've seen read my book, there's a photo of a place in Concord. It's a fish and chip shop and it's got a residential on top, telecommunications towers on top of that, an ATM machine in the shop. So it's just like four sources of revenue on one little property.
Yeah.
Word of warning, don't recommend living under telecommunications towers. Surely that's going to cause dramas. But
lots of EMF.
Maybe that's why the fish are bigger in the fish and chip shop.
Yeah, my wife hates the telecommunication towers for all the radio frequencies for residential purposes, but, you know, everyone's got an opinion. So.
I don't know what the science is behind it. I remember in, like, when I was growing up, people had this huge fear about it, like, oh, it causes cancer, this and this and that. I don't know if that's proven. Surely if it's there's concrete evidence, they wouldn't allow it.
I got 3 years or something.
Let's not go down to conspiracy theories.
let me grab some alpha oil and I'll put it on my head.
Moving on, well done, Jared.
All right. So these two kind of like come in hand in hand. So first one is removing underperforming tenants. So we touched on that kind of with retail about getting ones that like maybe take away from the complex. For instance, to say like you got a little friendly neighborhood center, having like, I don't want to bang out, someone who's covered in tattoos, like a tattoo parlor might not fit in with the demographic if it's an older kind of clientele going there, or a brothel or whatever it may be. Or even just a tenant that like is kind of causing dramas with the other tenants, like that can be, if that causes bad culture in the area, that just kind of stops rental increases, the kind of vibe of the area. So removing a tenant is actually quite important. Same thing if you've got like an industrial tenant. If it's a tenant who's slowly slipping away, not paying rent on time, things like that, why are you going to keep them long term? Like you might think, oh, I'm going to help them out. It's better having some rents better than none. But most businesses, and you'll actually attest to this, Jared, that are going downhill rarely pull themselves back. Like, so it's just a slippery slope that you get into. Sometimes it's better, like, if the market's grown, especially industrial, the last couple of years we're seeing 30% rental increases. If they were struggling a couple of years ago, like they're going to be able to handle the 30% rental increases. So once they kind of break something in the lease, sometimes it's worth, without sounding ruthless, cut your losses, put in a new tenant, the vacancy rates are tight enough, and get the performing tenant that way.
Absolutely. I like that. Yeah. The image of a complex can completely change based on the culture, like you said, based on one tenant. And it can really affect everybody else around that whole, precinct, I guess.
Yeah. We had one recently. We found a shop in like a retail complex, and the complex was pretty nice. But the butcher shop was like really grubby and kind of dirty looking. And it just made the whole complex feel bad. Like you kind of look at it and go, this is a grubby complex now. Whereas if it was like a really nice, fresh looking butcher shop, that would actually bring a vibe to the area and bring the foot traffic approaching and bring it up. So this is why retail is a bit of a harder game. You have to understand business as well as kind of like demographics of the area and what makes a successful business. Whereas industrial and office, it's pretty much a numbers game. Like you look at it and go, okay, what's a square meter rate? What can I get? I don't really care if my tenant's a panel beater or a spray painter or a fabricator or whatever it is. Again, case by case, if you've got like an industrial complex, like, you know, the Homewares industrial complexes where they've got like the fantastic furniture and the Bing Lee and the Good Guys, you wouldn't go put in a manufacturer in that one, for instance, because that's not going to add to it. So still sticking with that. But for most mum and dad's budgets, you're just going to buy in either like a distribution type industrial complex or like a service-based one, and then the tenants that come in, you'll kind of choose from there.
Yeah. Awesome. I think that you hit on a really good point. I just want to go back on that is like we're in a point in the market too where, you know, vacancy rates are low. So if you are listening to this and you're considering, oh, look, my tenant's not great, like it's better to change a tenant in a stronger market than wait. And then, no one knows what the future holds, but you don't want to be shifting tenants by force in a market where it's not as strong as it is today. So I think that's a really good point, Steve.
And I don't want to sugarcoat commercial. Vacancy rates will go up. Like they're at all-time lows now, like 0.5%. But generally what happens when you've got really, really tight markets, and the same thing happens with residential, developers start going, oh, there's a huge demand here. People are going to pay a price increase. And that's when they start buying land and building more stock. So more stock will come to the market. I don't know whether that's in 5 years' time, 10 years' time, or 15 years' time, but at some point it'll climb. And that's the cyclic nature of property. So getting a good tenant now and a long-term tenant is always valuable.
Yeah, love it. Is there anything else on your list there?
We've got two more, guys. I know you're getting impatient. All right, I'll hurry up, Jared.
All right, we got all in on one episode. Let's just cram it.
No, they're a bit quicker. So the next one's actually surprisingly the easiest one, and like it changes it hugely. It's actually just improving your property manager. So sometimes property managers don't have their fingers on the pulse. So some of the reasons we mentioned before about like increasing the rents, they're not doing that, or that it's managing the tenant poorly. But the biggest one I find is actually vacancy rates. If you've got a good property manager who does a good sales campaign and things like that, they get people in way quicker. I've had people who own properties and they're probably sat there vacant for 6 months and then they come to me going, oh, I can't get a tenant, what's going on? And they tell me their property manager, I'm like, oh, I don't really like them. And I put them onto a new one and it's filled in a month. So just having someone who's on the ground with contacts and knows the market with their big list of kind of tenants can actually help as well. So that's the easiest one. And people, this is where I said before, don't scrimp on property managers. Like paying an extra $500,000 a year is nothing if you've got like $1 million property giving you 60 grand a year. Like get the one that's always going to get top rent, keep a good tenant and keep tight vacancy rates as well.
What are we talking in terms of paying, decent premium for a good property manager? It might change based on the asset type as well, but like roughly.
Roughly, most property managers want to earn between kind of $4,000 and $7,000. So when I say four, that's for like a very stock standard kind of commercial. The percentage of management changes on the value. So obviously, as the value goes up, like you're looking probably around 7 to 10% on like $1 million, $2 million asset. And then if you go up to like $5 million, $10 million, that kind of comes down to like 3%. But like for their job, for them, like doing all the inspections, doing the fire testing, managing all the bills, checking up on the tenant, doing lease reviews and all that stuff, they want to make a few grand a year. No one's going to work for like $1,000, $2,000 a year. It's not worth it. They have to have kind of too many properties on the books.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're normally talking an extra $1,000 or $2,000. If you've got something a bit more complicated, they might charge you like $7,000, like if you've got multi-tenancy or something like that. But try not to focus on that. Like don't pay a premium for no reason, but make sure you're getting the value there. I get too many people that chase kind of low on, oh, this one's doing it for $2,000. When stuff goes wrong, you'll pay for it. All of a sudden the fine print comes out of, oh, this is not covered. This is not covered. And it's going to add up anyway.
Yeah.
All right. And then the last one, quick one, similar to residential development. So anything you can do on a resi in regards to like knockdown, rebuild, subdivide, add an extra dwelling, doing all that type of stuff, you can do on commercial, but you've obviously got the different types that you can add on as well. So you might have industrial, you add a retail on the front, or you knock down the big shed and you make something with 10 different tenants, or you make a whole retail strip or a mix of both, or even go back to residential. If it's zoned for residential as well and residential square meter rates are commanding a higher rent, maybe sell to a developer or build residential as well. So anything resi you can do there, you can do with commercial, but you've got the added complexity of all the other types you have to kind of worry about. And that's probably the hardest one where I get clients coming in like, oh, Steve, what should I do with this site? And there's no right answer because you need to actually analyze what you're doing, for instance. Like I'll go back to my cafe, for instance. Across the road, they're building a huge medical precinct, which is great for my cafe. However, should I knock it down and build like a specialized medical suite? Like that might actually be a good option there. I can also build residential up to 42 meters. Is that a better option? So sometimes having too many options makes the decision actually harder.
Decision fatigue.
Run the feasibility, mate.
There you go.
And there's too many feasibilities to do. Yeah.
Yeah. And you won't. And then you'll call a town planner or something and they'll kind of be like, well, you've got like five different options. There's no right. Generally, I always just keep it simple. Choose something that you know is guaranteed to make you money as opposed to shooting for the stars, and then that's how you benefit.
Depending on somebody's risk tolerance and what they could afford to do in terms of a development at that stage in their life, I guess.
The hard one with commercial is sometimes it's delayed as well. You buy a property and you can see that there's value add and you've got a five-year lease on the property, you're probably not going to do anything. And then when you get to the lease renewal and they say, we want to sign next another lease, you're kind of all of a sudden like, I've got a good tenant. I'm not doing anything. So, but again, same to residential. I'll try to buy a residential with some form of value add. But as long as the numbers stack up as its own individual one, knowing full well, I'm probably not going to do it. Like there's only a 10% chance I'll do it in the next 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Love it. I love it. There's so many good points there, Steve. Did you want to ask any questions before we wrap it up, Sam?
Nah, I think we nailed on some really massive ones. And I guess the underlying fundamentals are like, yes, commercial is, you know, it's a little bit more expensive to get into, but you know, don't shy away from thinking that there aren't multiple, and there's actually more value add strategies with commercial. So the biggest thing is, just running your numbers, similar to your situation, Steve, is, you know, the life is constantly changing, zoning changes, like your end use, yeah, you're not too sure. But when it comes down to that time where you have the financial capacity to do so, say, do your feasibility, run your numbers, and, you know, think about the long-term game too, especially development. Are you developing to hold or are you developing to sell? And then, as always, you've got to find good people to point you in the right directions. So thanks, Steve.
Just to be cheeky, Sam, we bought a warehouse in Perth for 280 grand last week. So it's not necessarily more expensive to get into commercial.
Oh, well, okay. Like what was the cash in required after stamps and all your fees? And
so what's that? Oh, so 280 less 30% deposit times that. So it's 84 grand for the deposit plus stamp duty is going to be, what's that, like 12 grand. So you're probably looking around 100 grand total.
Oh, wow.
100 grand. It's not bad, mate.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, people can get – see, this is the misconception that I had before. It was just a few podcast episodes we had to go, Steve, that I was like, oh, I might just wait and just bank up more and more and more cash and get in at a different entry level than where I am now. But I could have started earlier if I wanted to, really.
There's just a balance. Like, without sugarcoating, like the cheaper ones – are a little bit higher risk because you get higher turnover of tenants, about the roads are yield a little bit and things like that. And there's not as much bang for buck, but you can get cheap. You can buy a car spot in Sydney CBD for $80,000 if you want. Don't recommend it because there's zero value add to that. Surprisingly a good return on investment though, like because people pay like 5 to 10 grand a year for rent to have a dedicated car spot. So cash on cash is actually not that bad of a return. But again, you're not getting the land component, which is not going to get the capital appreciation the same.
Yeah, really good points. There's so many good points in this podcast episode, guys. Go back and re-listen to it because, yeah, we went through them pretty fast. Also, a bunch of these are in Steve's book, which we've mentioned multiple times. If you haven't yet got it, I should say, Property Pals Code. There'll be a link in the description. And, yeah, thanks, Steve.
Thank you, guys. Peace out.
See you in the next one.